In 1934, along the banks of the River Sa'an, which is one of the tributary rivers to the Great Lake of Cambodia, found in the central province of Kampong Thom, two young brothers are splashing each other and playing around while the relentless heat of the November sun beats down across the village they've grown up in, Prek Spal. The monsoon rains have made the river that flows by their village bulge up toward the wooden stilts of their houses. But this would soon give way to the hottest part of the year. The timeless ebb and flow of nature and life in their village would continue through another cycle, despite some of the big changes that the country itself had been going through over the last 50 years or so. The two brothers, 6-year-old Nep and 8-year-old Saw, would continue to enjoy their afternoon in the silty, golden brown river until they had to return home for their mother's evening meal, a beautiful bowl of fresh steamed rice and a sour, fishy kind of soup. Walking back home along the main, well, road would be a strong word, let's say the well-worn track that supports the carts which travel to and from the provincial capital of Kampong Thom, which is just a few kilometers to the west. On the way, they talk about the old story of a dark magic user, a kind of wizard, or Dmop in Khmer, who had been a blasphemer, and as punishment for this crime, his mouth was shrunk until it was no bigger than a straw. They laughed at the image, but then the elder brother, Saw, would relay in a knowing kind of way that older brothers tend to do, that solving this predicament for the wizard led to the invention of the thin noodles that both he and his brother enjoyed so much. As the sun began creeping behind the palm trees that lay off in the distance against the horizon, Saw told Nep more scary stories, like the one about the glutton spirits, disgusting demons that could float in midair, consisting only of a rotting head and a tangle of organs and intestines that drooped from the neck downward. These nasty spirits would come out to feed on the filth and dead animals that were submerged in the mud of the riverbank, and just might want to try the taste of a little 6-year-old boy. Saw laughed and hugged his little brother. They were very close, the two youngest of six. His father, Loth, and his mother, Soknem, had actually had 9 children, but 3 of them had died while they were very young. The world of superstition and belief permeated all aspects of their lives, and the offerings made to the local ancestor spirit, the Nig Ta, were believed to be very important for their good luck and prosperity, as were the Theravada Buddhist teachings that informed the young boy's view of the world. Saw didn't only have to rely on the supernatural to try and scare his little brother, though. He could always retell the stories that had been passed from his grandfather down to his father about the much more real, more human dangers that could potentially strike. Stories about armies from Thailand or Vietnam, hordes of men who would burn whole villages to the ground. He heard that the men from Vietnam would gouge out your eyes and pack the empty sockets with salt before burying you alive. While the Siamese, well, they'd steal anything that they could find, and they carry off women and children after enslaving the men they decided not to kill. These kinds of stories weren't completely made up. They were passed on by elders in the village who had actually lived through the so-called years of calamity, when Cambodia had been continually invaded, subjugated, and torn from side to side by one or the other of their more powerful neighbours. These tumultuous times had led to a kind of existential crisis, and led many to think that maybe their whole country, their whole Khmer race, would eventually cease to exist. The two boys kept joking and laughing as they walked, calling out to the fishermen on their canoes or chasing the occasional chicken along the muddy path. All of the houses in the village they walked by, of which there were about 20, were classic Khmer-style thatch with wooden walls. However, their family was comparatively well off, evidenced by their tile roof and the larger amount of land that their father owned in the village. In fact, their family even had ties to the royal family in Phnom Penh, a city that was now prospering under the colonial wing of a French protectorate, a term coined to perhaps sound less like the process it actually described, which is of a territory that is dependent on, controlled, and organized by another state. The French had controlled Cambodia since the 1860s, as well as conquering the Khmer's hereditary enemy to the east, the Vietnamese. Indochina had fallen into the dominant system of the world, imperialism. And by the 1930s, the capital city had sights and sounds that were far removed from the village that the boys were growing up in, which still, in many ways, looked the same as it had for centuries. The boy's auntie, Miss Cheng, had obtained a post in the household of King Norodom, sometimes called the first modern king of Cambodia, as it was under his rule that the French protectorate was established. Miss Cheng's daughter, Miak, was then chosen as a royal concubine for Norodom's son and the future king of Cambodia, Monivong. In 1930, Miak, having finished her role as concubine, had then become head of the royal bedchamber and secured a status well enough to invite two of Sa and Nep's elder siblings, brother Suong and sister Roeng, to join her in the capital. Suong became a palace officer, and Roeng, she also became a concubine. While certainly a good connection for a family in a provincial village to have, it wasn't exactly rare either, as the rulers of Cambodia often had more than 100 wives or consorts. Soon enough, Sa too would be joining his elder siblings in the capital city. The rice paddies that their family owned had been producing increasing wealth for his father, and his mother had hopes that their children would be educated at one of the new Western-style primary schools that the French had set up in Phnom Penh. Still more than 40 years away from taking the name Pol Pot and leading his country into a nightmare, the little boy from Pek Spao was friendly and curious to see how different life would be in the city, in a country that was still finding its place in the 20th century. Hello there, and welcome back to In the Shadows of Utopia, the series aimed at explaining the Khmer Rouge Revolution within the context of Cambodian history. And it is at this point in the story that we are arriving at the end of a pivotal chapter in that history and the beginning of another. We have explained the rise and fall of the Khmer Empire, the troubled Dark Ages, or middle period of Cambodian history, where the country transformed from the grandiosity that was on display at Angkor to the now quite submissive territory that sits between its more powerful neighbours in Siam and Vietnam. Now, we approach the 20th century and the region's colonization by the French. I began this episode with that little scene from the early years of Pol Pot's life so we could get a sense of the cultural context that he grew up in, but also to reinforce how the history of Cambodia leading up into the 20th century, that is, the country that his father and grandfather lived in, will be an important part of explaining what happens to the country later in the 1970s. Three aspects of this will be discussed in this episode. First, the French Revolution, and some of the unique aspects of French history that will be relevant to Cambodia. Second, the treatment of Cambodia by Vietnam in the 19th century. And lastly, the so-called Years of Calamity that we spoke about earlier. These are going to precede the French intervention and colonization of Indochina that occurs by the end of the 19th century. By the end of this episode, we will have established the key factors of Cambodian history that occur prior to the colonial period. And the journey from Angkor Wat to the killing fields of Chong Ek will be opened up into the lives of those who will design and implement one of the most tragic periods of mass death in modern times. So let's begin in France, with perhaps the most famous revolution of them all, and see the interesting parallels it presents for the eventual Cambodian Revolution. On the 20th of June, 1791, in the middle of the night, His Majesty, King Louis XVI, as well as his wife, Marie Antoinette, and their two children, as well as a few servants, this small party were preparing to do something fairly irregular for people with king or queen in their title. They were preparing to flee their country, the country that until recently, Louis had ruled as an absolute monarch. Dressing up as ordinary citizens and escaping through a kind of secret passageway, they climbed into a carriage and started their clandestine journey toward the Austrian border. The last time we visited upon Louis XVI, he was in his palace at Versailles, 4 years before this fateful night, which would come to be known as his flight from France. We had spoke about him when the French Catholic missionary / chief political strategist / weapons dealer and diplomat, Pierre de Barhain, had come to visit and make the case for French military as well as financial assistance in helping his friend, Prince Nguyen An, gain control of Vietnam. And while they did eventually sign a treaty that would have guaranteed Nguyen An some of this aid, Louis had actually reneged on this deal. He had not really seen the point of pursuing it, and once the priest had returned to Southeast Asia, he, as well as his prince, found that he would not be afforded even a fraction of the 4 frigates and 2,000 soldiers that had been originally promised to him. Despite this setback, Pierre had still gone on to find that military and financial support from elsewhere, and his mission to help the Vietnamese prince back to power went on over the next decade or so, and was eventually successful. During this time back in France, however, just the overall situation had become extremely disastrous, especially for Louis. The French economy was in ruins, debt was out of control, the people were hungry, and a lot of people were pretty upset with the king. Louis XVI was a relatively incompetent leader, and he was left to rule a society that was in transition. And the fact that the vast majority of French society thought that his wife was pretty awful was not helping the situation get any better. We had a brief discussion about some of the factors that were influencing this unease in France at this time in the last episode. It was a time of enlightenment, change, and growing dissatisfaction with, for lack of a better phrase, simply the way things were. And I want you to think about that phrase for a second. I mean, you've no doubt been on the receiving end of it in some kind of situation in your own life. Some kind of barrier. I don't know, maybe you've missed a plane by just a couple of minutes, or some kind of financial issue where you just cannot get around it. You've got some authority on the other side of a desk explaining to you that despite your feelings or the fact that this might be genuinely unfair, well, unfortunately, that's just the way it works. Or, I'm sorry, ma'am, but that's just the way it is. Well, the way it was in France, and indeed most of Europe during this period, was long established. You had kings, aristocrats, and the nobility, as well as the clergy, and these classes were simply above the rest of society. In France, this was divided into the three estates, the first and second being made of the nobility and the clergy, and the third was just about everyone else, in fact about 97% of the population. Much of this system was simply based on the brute forces of determinism, or luck. I mean, you don't get to choose when or where you're born or what family you are born into. The seeming unfairness of this hierarchical system was explained away with the great chain of being, which if you have a healthy belief in the will of God or fate in general, can be used to substantiate the claim that this is how society had to work. The king, who was often viewed as a kind of vessel of God's will, naturally sat at the top of this chain of being, and he ruled completely. This is that absolute monarchical system that we were talking about. This was accompanied by a fairly lavish lifestyle, shall we say. Almost an obscenely conspicuous one as well, during a time when the majority of society could barely feed themselves. If you set this system up and let it run for a few hundred years, after a while, there's a chance that eventually the massive amount of people who are participating in the lower rungs of this society may become less than happy with their station in life, particularly when this third estate was the primary source that the other estates could tax in order to fund their wars, lifestyles, and debts. The financial aspect of this is usually the first and easiest aspect of the French Revolution to explain, but it's certainly not the only factor at play here. It could be said that European history, in general, was just moving toward an event like this. But why it happened exactly how and when it did in France can be explained with some of the context that we spoke of in that last episode. We spoke about the Enlightenment and the dissemination of the ideas that came out of this movement into wider society through a host of modern devices. We spoke about new things like the coffee shop, a place where people could sit around and drink stimulants and talk about the ideas they were having. What were you reading? What are you thinking about? New political ideas and movements that accompanied this spread of critical thinking started to sort of spread into the wider society. If you couple these intellectual forces with those of the economic mismanagement, the rising inequality between the classes, or the plunge into poverty that many faced due to an extremely poor harvest in 1788-89, as well as adding in some ludicrous taxation of this increasingly poor section of the population, well, you've got all of the ingredients for one of the defining moments in Western civilization. Now, with all of that being said, I'm by no means an expert on this moment in history. Not only am I not an historian, I'm certainly not a scholar of French history, and many people have spent their entire academic careers teasing apart and analysing this moment in history, so in an effort not to embarrass myself too much, what follows is a discussion of the French Revolution that will be fairly bare bones. However, I will be paying more attention to the aspects of this moment in history that will become familiar when we start discussing the Cambodian Revolution. After all, it has been suggested by historians such as Philip Short that some of the ideas that come out of the French Revolution will be almost inspirational to those that design the Cambodian one. So with an eye on bridging the historical narrative between old regime France and the one that will colonize Indochina, we will explore the French Revolution, but with an eye on building a vocabulary that we can use when we will eventually discuss the events of revolutionary Cambodia. With that in mind, let's kind of return to the story here. Let's return to King Louis's flight from his palace in June 1792. Now, his attempted escape from what had become an increasingly perilous situation for he and his family in a new French society that had begun its revolution more than 3 years earlier is extremely important for our story. By this time, many of the most recognizable chapters of the French Revolution had already been carried out. The new government that rejected the broken three estates voting system had been formed, with the infamous tennis court oath. The Bastille, a prison, armory, and barracks which symbolized the royal authority, had been stormed by the peasantry and torn apart brick by brick. Members of the aristocracy had been murdered and their heads paraded around on pikes. The Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, the Women's March on Versailles, revolutionary France was at war, and the revolution itself had already been bathed in blood. Privilege itself had been targeted, and there was this real and radical attempt to abolish, dismantle, and wash away the old regime, often called the Ancien Régime. It was an attempt to tear down the structure of the way it is and replace it with something new, a system based in large part on the Enlightenment principles and philosophy that we discussed in the last episode. Now, with any kind of political movement, there's usually a spectrum within it where people might be divided by their fundamental goals. In modern political terms, you'll often hear the phrase, right-wing or left-wing or some kind of centrist position. In fact, it was from the French Revolution that we actually get this way of speaking about political difference. This left and right dynamic and what we think each side of that debate means for the political party that's aligned there. Well, that's actually to do with where people sat in the new French government while the king was still involved. Those that were more conservative sat to his right, while the most radical revolutionaries, well, they were sitting on the left of the room. And the most left of the left were called the Jacobins. We'll speak more about them in a moment, but it is that group, the most left of the left, that will take this revolution to its most extreme ends. In the years between the start of the revolution, leading up to Louis XVI's attempted escape from France and the revolution, he had basically been kept under a kind of house arrest, and regularly forced to speak out in favour of the revolution. However, and this probably goes without saying, a political movement that sought to remove the foundations of your power and reduce your status from a kind of quasi-godlike figure to a mere man, like everyone else, was probably not going to be your favourite thing in the world, especially if you thought that they might also murder you one day. With that resentment and probably fear going through his mind, he and his wife Marie Antoinette, who really was just utterly despised by the French people, in no small part because of her behaviour as well as her ties to the Austrian royal family, had secretly hatched a plan with some loyal royalists to escape into Austrian territory. When he got there, Louis would borrow an army, and he would then use that Austrian army to retake France and re-establish the monarchy and the Ancien Régime. Leaving in the middle of the night, he also left behind a letter which utterly denounced the revolution. That's the kind of letter you leave for your boss when, after years of mistreatment and hatred, you think, I'm leaving forever and I'll leave this note here and I'll never see them again and they'll really get a piece of my mind. Now, when you quit a job like that, you hope that you never actually have to crawl back there and work again. And unfortunately for Louis, even despite he and his family's amazing disguises, well, if you're famous enough for your face to be on your country's money, there is a chance that you might get recognized in this big escape, which he eventually was. He was taken back to Paris, well, escorted back, and he would not be able to recover from this seemingly obvious betrayal of his people. The king was supposed to be God's chosen one, and the people of that king were his subjects. You weren't a citizen. You were a part of the great chain of being. However, in this instance, the king's flight had proven that he didn't really care about France. He only cared about himself and regaining his own power, even if that meant invading France with another country's army. As I said before, the results of the king's flight are particularly important for this story because they branch out in a few different ways. Firstly, as I alluded to before, revolutionary France was actually already at war with the other European powers. The revolution in France and its radical take on what the role of the monarchy should do, well, that was not going unnoticed in the rest of the world. All the other kings and queens around Europe are looking on in shock and horror as, you know, one of their own is being toppled by the peasants. Could this happen to them too? Their whole, you know, club was being threatened by this revolution. So they mobilized armies to stem what could be seen as a potential tide of revolutionary ideas coming into their own countries. So the revolution itself was the target of outside enemies. Often coalitions even, of European powers that had previously been bitter enemies. Well, that doesn't matter anymore. We've got to team up and invade French territory and get rid of this revolution. We've got to restore the monarchy and the way things were. The revolution was that threatening to the status quo. So, what did this mean for the French? Well, the revolution, therefore, needed to defend itself. It needed an army. And an army that was loyal to France, rather than the king. A massive amount of conscription ensued. Now, conscription is never altogether popular, and it did cause conflict, particularly in the countryside, where the people that had not been completely enamored by this intellectual revolution that was going on in Paris now had to deal with the revolution coming to them, as their men and their boys were conscripted into this new army. An army that was no longer fighting for the king. So how would that process have usually happened? Well, basically in most of history, armies are formed on the basis of the will of an absolute ruler. You know, usually a king or a queen. As we've said, you're just kind of naturally the king's subject. And if you are going to be serving in or dying in a war of his will, then so be it. That is your lot in life. That in and of itself was a pretty significant motivation, as well as, you know, the spoils of war. The mercenary angle here, where fighting would mean money. Well, following the king's attempted escape from France, where he ostensibly betrayed the entirety of the French people and conspired to commit treason, well, how do you get that massive army together when you can't just say, the king says so? For a revolution that was based in large part at simply removing the royalist elements of society, how were they going to achieve this? The revolution couldn't just put a new king in power and say, okay, you have to do what this guy says. This political movement had to harness a different kind of energy in order to mobilize a new national military. And that word, national, nationalism, nationalist, that will be the key here. That is one of the results of the king's flight. The difference now was, you're not fighting for your king anymore. You're no longer a subject of a king. So, who are you fighting for? What are you fighting for? Your country. Your nation. The very land you live on. Your culture. This becomes a source of energy for those who must join this new military. And it is why the French Revolution is often thought to be one of the first modern examples of nationalism in practice. And this is exemplified very well in what would soon become the French national anthem that was written in this period, La Marseillaise. And if you will excuse me, I'm going to half kind of sing it in English to you, just so you can get an idea of some of the lyrics and how rousing they are. It's a very good national anthem. Arise, children of the fatherland, our day of glory has arrived. Against us the bloody flag of tyranny is raised. The flag is raised. Okay, so you remember this is a song written as war had been declared against the revolution, against the people of France. That's the bloody flag of tyranny. The old way things were. Now the next verse. To arms, citizens. Citizens, not subjects. That's who's going to be doing the fighting. The song is a proper call to arms. It speaks of the opposing armies in the fields and how we need to kill them and spill their blood. There's some pretty heavy stuff in there about these guys coming to take our women and slit our men's throats, and basically it's all designed to rouse this feeling within you, this energy for your country. In the same way that you might hear a love song that makes you feel all kinds of feelings, or you might hear a song that's designed to get you out of your chair and have a bit of a dance. Some songs are written to harness a different energy within. And this energy, the energy that's produced here, that's nationalism. Because I'm not just using the French Revolution as just a chronological, you know, what happened to France from here to here. I also want to use it to sort of create a vocabulary for the series as we keep going. And one of the most important things to be able to use without explaining it too much in the 20th century is nationalism. And I want to define it as a kind of mental energy. And it's an energy that I think you could probably easily relate to, or at least identify in the modern world. Some people seem to have a lot of this energy. You probably know someone, or you've at least seen someone that, you know, gets a tattoo of their country's flag right on their chest. In Australia, people often get these Southern Cross tattoos, which is a kind of constellation that is apparently just Australian. Some people are more toward the other end of this spectrum. Maybe they don't even know the words to the national anthem. Others are probably somewhere in between. Perhaps even the person that simply has a healthy belief in maybe some of the values that seem unique to their nation. For instance, in Australia, there's this idea of the Aussie battler, and it's sort of tied to this story from World War I. General ideas about the so-called American dream might also be an example of this. Now, while those three categories of people probably have different, reserves of this nationalist energy, sometimes governments or political parties or armies or some other functionary of the state will seek to either bolster, create, or harness that nationalist energy within the wider population to further some kind of goal. Maybe it's a new tax, or it could be a response to a natural disaster, or maybe, in a more serious circumstance, it could be a call to arms. And this is a metaphor that I'm quite fond of, so I'm probably going to dig it up a few times throughout this series. But if we think of nationalism as literally an energy source, I think it might be something like coal. It's fairly common, pretty easy to dig up. You don't have to have particularly much technological finesse to burn it and get your electricity. And it isn't, in and of itself, a particularly bad thing. I mean, until you dig it up, it's just kind of sitting there. And powering a steam train seemed like a pretty okay thing to do. But it does have a dark side as well. It leaves scars on the land. It pollutes the air and the atmosphere. In the same way that nationalism might have its uses for good now and again, there is a reason why nationalist movements are often associated with some of the more sinister, xenophobic, and violent political systems. Nationalism gets a lot of energy from the base of human instincts. Fear of outsiders. Protect you and yours at the expense of others. Your way of doing things is better than everyone else. And your land is sacred. It's almost like nationalism is this kind of fire within you, and if it's given more fuel and more fuel, it can be used to make you do more and more things. Perhaps even go to war or kill your neighbor. And if we take this to its extreme end, we could say that coal is one of the most dangerous elements of global warming, a complete human disaster. And perhaps we could relate that to the use of nationalism within the Nazi ideology and the complete human disaster that led to. So if we're thinking of nationalism as a kind of political energy, put a flag in that. We'll refer to that later in the series. Maybe I'll come up with a different kind of one for communism. Anyway, it's widely accepted that a kind of modern nationalism is thought to have been born from the French Revolution. And it's a good time anyway to get this concept in place. Also because it works quite well for this new French army. And if we're going back to the revolution, in the early 1790s, it is beset by enemies from the outside, and wars have to be waged to protect France and the revolution. So there's this dynamic of the revolutionaries having to fight wars to protect their ideas. But there's also a sense of paranoia about the possibility of enemies that may be within France, within the revolution. I mean, the king had been one of these enemies. There must be other remnants of the old regime, or people who were looking to sabotage the revolution. The flight of the king forever tarred him as a traitor, despite attempts by some to say that, oh no, he'd been kidnapped. That story never stuck, however, and eventually, as the revolution became more and more focused on removing the elements of the ancien regime, they had to start with the head of that regime. And I do mean that literally. In 1793, the French revolutionary government, which was influenced heavily by that Jacobin section of the National Assembly, and led by a young lawyer, Maximilien Robespierre, well, the revolution took a massive step when they voted to execute the king. The device used to do this was named after Dr. Joseph Ignace Guillotin, and it was the Enlightenment's method of killing, but with equality. And it would become the symbol of the terrible violence that would be associated with the French Revolution, in much the same way that the extermination camps of Nazi Germany, the machetes of Rwanda, and indeed the killing fields of Cambodia would be used to symbolize these periods of mass death or murder. The need for an execution device like this is kind of strange for the revolutionaries, as it was certainly not the original intent for the revolution. I mean, they'd even outlawed capital punishment in their first constitution. However, the need to protect the revolution had necessitated the use of terror by the state, and this was spurred on by radical ideologues like Jean-Paul Marat, who penned paranoid calls for bloodshed from a medicinal bathtub that he was confined to. Eventually, a 12-person contingent, known as the Committee for Public Safety, and headed by Robespierre, would turn increasingly toward violence and terror as a means of safeguarding their revolution, from enemies abroad as well as within. The revolution became more total. It sought to create a new revolutionary culture. Old titles were abolished, and there was a general de-Christianization. There was even a new revolutionary calendar based on the decimal system. It had 10 days a week, a 10-hour day, 100 minute hours, and 100 seconds in each minute. This is pretty fundamental stuff. This is really, you know, tearing down the roots of a society here. This is the difference between spending an afternoon and rearranging the furniture in your lounge room to getting one of those renovation shows to tear down half of your house and build you a new, I don't know, open space kitchen. When you are resetting the structure of society, down to the time it takes for an hour to go by, starting the calendar at year one, this is all-encompassing. It's also worth putting a little flag there. I mean, the phrase year zero will be familiar to many people with its association with the Khmer Rouge. And it's these kinds of parallels that will really begin to stack up when we talk about the rest of the revolution. Anyway, these revolutionaries were attempting to refashion culture, not just politics. And after they'd killed the king, as well as the Queen Marie Antoinette, well, there were many more people that would also need to be executed in order for this new society to prosper and grow. And the revolution certainly did have its enemies. I mean, we've already talked about the outside ones, but within there was, you know, civil conflicts going on. There were some people that didn't quite support the revolution as much as they thought they should. But the period that the revolution was going to move into, known as the Reign of Terror, was an attempt to eradicate anyone who was not sufficiently revolutionary. Anyone could be considered to be one of these enemies within. And it is then that the revolution began to eat its own children. The Reign of Terror, which is a period that starts from around about 1793 and goes until about 1794, although the dates may be different depending on the historian you talk to, saw more than 12,000 people executed at the guillotine. Perhaps more than 40,000 in total would be killed in all of France. Not just noblemen or members of the clergy, not just the conspicuous members of the old regime. Anyone could be accused of being a counter-revolutionary and had your head cut off. Slandering patriotism was considered a capital offence. Using old terms of address, like Madame or Monsieur, instead of the new way, citizen. The Reign of Terror was a kind of emergency government. It was thought to be a necessary protection for the revolution, until everything could sort of normalise. Those within politics, even high-ranking and famous members of the Jacobin Party, who voiced their opinion that perhaps this Reign of Terror was going a little bit too far, well, they weren't considered to be just expressing a difference of political opinion, but instead committing treason, and the punishment was the guillotine. Paranoia was rampant, and the heads continued to roll. This is the emotional peak of the revolution, and it will only end when the head of this movement, Robespierre himself, was denounced as a tyrant. He was arrested and executed. This led to another revolution within the revolution, but it was one that stemmed the terror. After this, the movement would take a more conservative turn. The revolution had begun with bloodshed, and that precedent for violence was a constant throughout. The paranoia that was provoked by the real threat of outside powers working to extinguish it, or the possibility of those within France who were still loyal to the way things were, these were real fears. But they were expanded to such an extent, and to include such a vast amount of the population, that the violence that would engulf the revolution would not be sustainable. This revolution was a moment where the needs of the peasantry and the ideas of a new intellectual class combined in such a way that could sustain a political movement that in the past, well, I mean, there had been other moments where a starving people might have risen up and, you know, revolted against a ruler. But they certainly didn't have the impact that the French Revolution did. They would eventually be crushed by some army or dissolved by some other means. But this wasn't really a peasant-led uprising. This was a political and intellectual movement that harnessed the energy of that massive part of the population, and to much greater effect. It was based on Enlightenment values, and these can still be easily identified with. Equality or the abolition of slavery, we naturally champion these movements. These are modern causes, and good things did come from this revolution. But it was brutal and violent. And particularly during the Reign of Terror, there was many unnecessary deaths. It's also a terrific example of the use of fear and terror, not only to protect a political goal, but to also change the society itself into the shape that these ideologues envisioned. And this will become a tactic used by many revolutionary leaders throughout history. Leaders that have to ask themselves, how much violence is necessary to ensure my revolution? How many people need to die so that my enlightened and egalitarian movement can be successful? If you're going to create a utopian society, how many lives is that worth? 1,000? 1,000,000? The French Revolution was a pivotal moment in the history of the modern world, and it kind of sets us up nicely to join the story that we had left in France with Pierre de Bahain and up until the dawn of French Indochina. We will also see real echoes of the French Revolution when we discuss the revolution in Cambodia. After all, this was a paranoid government that used terror, violence, and murder to shape its population into line, into an ideology, and falling outside of that line, or being perceived to go against it, being a counter-revolutionary, well, that was also a death sentence. In the years after the Reign of Terror, there was a new constitution formed, a general conservative swing against what had been a pretty extreme few years. The people of France had had to deal with a lot since 1789, when the revolution initially began. The wars, the taxes, all the new constitutions and changes. The political landscape was in disarray, and perhaps there was even a desire by some sections of the population to revert back to something that looked a bit more like the Ancien Régime. Perhaps there was even a space for a strong ruler to come back and to centralize power and command different aspects of the nation. Well, that shape was filled by a certain young general from Corsica named Napoleon Bonaparte. In the late 1790s, Napoleon had become famous for his prowess in France's revolutionary wars. Napoleon came back to Paris and staged a coup. And he then went on to become an authoritarian leader and gave himself the title of emperor. He seized the revolution and made himself the center of it. After about a decade of war, known as the Napoleonic Wars, in which he conquered large amounts of Europe, he eventually and fatefully invaded Russia. And he was doing pretty well too, until he got to Moscow and... well, you don't want to still be in Moscow when the winter comes. I'll skip the details here, as I'm sure many people are aware of the story. But of the 600,000 men that Napoleon brought on that campaign, only 100,000 would come back to France, and barely at that. The defeat in Russia ruined Napoleon. His spell was broken. He was exiled to an island. He did return a bit later. But then he got beaten again at Waterloo, and this would end the entire period of war in Europe. It would have long-lasting consequences as well, including the spread of some of the aspects of the French Revolution through war, an aspect like the Napoleonic Code, which was a set of legal reforms. These were adopted in much of continental Europe, and still set the basis for many legal codes around the globe today. Another outcome of all this tumultuous fighting and territories being gained and lost in Europe was the Congress of Vienna. This Congress in Vienna brought the big European powers that were still standing at the end of all this. And it was a plan to get everyone together and say, okay, what are we going to do now? There's all these new ideas and everyone wants this new territory. How do we get things back to a stable situation after the French Revolutionary Wars and then the Napoleonic ones? What are we going to do? They also include the new French leaders and give them a role in the negotiations, which was a smart move that actually wouldn't be repeated about 100 years later at the end of World War I, when Germany's basically excluded and just given the outcome of the First World War. But we won't talk about that now. What this was an attempt to restructure Europe, with the idea of balance of power at the core. The balance of power being a theory within international relations. And it suggests that an equilibrium of powerful states, rather than one particularly powerful one, is a more stable system and will encourage less conflict between the states. Most of the territory that had been conquered by France was redistributed, and different states were given territory in a way that would kind of keep everyone happy and equal, and hopefully not allow too many new wars. Kind of worked as well. I mean, there wouldn't be another general European war until, well, like we said, about 100 years later. Anyway, the Congress made it clear that the monarchy should return to France, and although many of the deep changes that had occurred in the revolution were maintained, aspects of the aristocracy made a bit of a comeback. The greater degree of equity under the law, as well as the maintenance of that new French nationalism, however, that stayed the same. It was as if the old regime was being invited back again, but some of the rules that they'd had to play by would be tweaked. Another significant return to form was made by the Catholic Church. Promoted once again to the state religion of France, the church was looked to in this instance to help make the country whole again after what had been such a fractious period of history. The 40 years or so after 1815, when the Congress took place, weren't exactly smooth sailing though. There was a to-ing and fro-ing in France as well as in Europe in general, as some of the ideas that were espoused by the revolution were sorted out and tried to be fit into the new societies. There was a real dawn of nations here, and in these societies, there was a mix with some of the old regime and new way of doing things. Monarchies still prevailed, empires were still sought after, and territories were won and lost. Another absolutely game-changing revolution that was going on in this time was the industrial one. This had been gaining momentum for about 50 years, and it was giving shape to how the next half of the 19th century and most of the 20th century was going to play out. Now, for me, writing this episode, it was just too much to try and do the French Revolution as well as the industrial one in the same episode. So we will return to the Industrial Revolution, as well as some of the reactions to it, like socialism, and indeed communism, in a later episode. But for this episode's story, I want to return to France at the beginning of what will be known as their Second Republic. And it's one that will be led by the nephew of Napoleon, and he would be the first directly elected president of France, Napoleon III. And as you can probably tell, the monarchic restoration had been fairly short-lived. Control was once again in the hands of a leader who proclaimed himself as an emperor. And what do emperors need most? Empire. France had lost most of its overseas assets, first in the period leading up to the French Revolution, and then again after the defeat of Napoleon. And as the mid-19th century is around about the time where a second wave of imperialism and European colonization begins, after what had been a little bit of a lull in those rapid conquests of regions around the globe when we talked about it in the last episode. Well, the newly powered up industrialized European powers are on the stage, and there began a new thirst for overseas territory and empire once again. And France was positioned as one of the most powerful states, so naturally it needed to expand. Following the conquest of Algiers in 1830, attentions were turned to Southeast Asia, and a possible area to set up a presence in the region. In the 1850s, it became clear that a number of French missionaries in the area of Vietnam were being persecuted. And this would require a punitive response from the French Empire, particularly now that Christianity was in this resurgent period within France. So, let's return to Vietnam and Cambodia and discuss the years leading up to the French colonization of their land. Because we are wrapping up our pre-colonial history of Cambodia, Vietnam, and the entire region, really, I just want to position ourselves back there, in and around the 1800s again. And as you recall, Prince Nguyen An had led a victorious unification of Vietnam, and proclaimed himself Emperor Chia Long. Following this unification, Vietnam was in a very strong position, and the restoration of the Nguyen dynasty was able to turn this strength into renewed domination of territory in Cambodia. As we know, the 200 or so years before the French colonial period was marked by competing interests of the Vietnamese and the Thai, and while tug of war is not exactly a good metaphor to be using here, it does kind of capture the aspect of back and forth that Cambodia was feeling between its two neighbours. In the time period we're discussing here, the early 1800s, Gia Long becoming emperor, well, Cambodia's more under the influence of the Thai at that moment, where kings were in place who made tribute to the Thai court. And on that note, on tribute, I realise it's something that we haven't spent too much time talking about so far, and I just want to get a quick explanation from historian David Chandler in his book A History of Cambodia, because it's quite an important facet of how these kingdoms functioned during this time period. So this is Chandler on how the hierarchy of these kingdoms was expressed in this system of tribute. Quote, "The two most important characteristics of post-Angkorian Cambodia were the shift in the country's centre of gravity from Angkor toward Phnom Penh, with the commercial and demographic ramifications that the move implied, and the roles played by the Thai and Vietnamese. 19th century Cambodia, therefore, must be seen in part against the background of its foreign relations. These relations were carried out with two countries, Vietnam and Siam, and occurred within a framework of rivalry between the two larger kingdoms. The rivalry sprang from the unwillingness of either court to accept the other as its equal or superior. This unwillingness, in turn, can be traced in part to the traditional language of tributary diplomacy, which stressed the inequality between the sender and the recipient of tribute. A major objective of Southeast Asian diplomacy in the 19th century was the ritualized expression of differential status through the ceremonial exchange of gifts. The rules for the tributary exchanges grew out of the particular system in which they occurred. The Thai and the Vietnamese, for example, had separate systems, but they overlapped inside of Cambodia. From the Vietnamese point of view, Vietnam was above Cambodia, just as China was above Vietnam." End quote. What Chandler is discussing here is a complex system where the gifts that you give another kingdom tells them a lot about how you feel about them. He goes on to discuss this dynamic as being particularly condescending toward the Cambodians from both the Thai and Vietnamese. He does say, however, that the Thai system, as with other aspects of society that we've already discussed, was more similar to the Khmer and made more sense when considering what they were exchanging as tribute. Now, what do I mean by that? It would be like if you lived in a really cold inland climate, and one of your relatives, every holiday season, they kept giving you swimsuits or beach hats or sun cream, something like that. And when you looked at them as to say, "Why are you giving me this? Don't you care about me?" They say, "What? What do you mean? This is the stuff I give as gifts. This is what works for me. I don't get your problem." This is, again, a fairly imprecise metaphor, but I hope you get my meaning here, in that the gifts themselves didn't make sense when they were going between these cultures. So from the Cambodian perspective, the gifts that they were getting from the Thai, while they were still patronizing and expressed that they were lower than the Thai, the gifts themselves made sense to them. While the gifts that were received from Vietnam also expressed the hierarchy that was in place there, but they didn't understand exactly what they were receiving. The impression I'm trying to impart here is not that the Thai were particularly better than the Vietnamese in this aspect, but they were just different. And the cultural divide between the Vietnamese and the Cambodians and the Thai was particularly felt on that Vietnamese side. And in practice, what this dynamic looked like was both of these kingdoms treating Cambodia as a bit more like a burden than a respected kingdom. And they were expecting Cambodia to be thankful for whatever protection that they might afford this country. But in practice, this protection looked actually a fair bit more like control. And how this control of Cambodia from either the Thai side or the Vietnamese side, in and around the period of about 1800 to 1840, gets a little bit complex. So in the next part of the episode, we're just going to go through a fairly simplified version as Cambodia goes from being under the Thai influence toward the Vietnamese. But that Vietnamese influence turns into a complete control and administration of Cambodia by Vietnam and geared completely toward Vietnamese interests. Chandler even goes as far to say that Cambodia basically ceases to be an independent or recognizable state for large chunks of this time period. Because we did slightly begin this discussion toward the end of the last episode, what I'm going to do is skip ahead slightly to around 1811. And that's when King Chan is on the throne in Cambodia, and due to a variety of factors, begins looking toward Vietnam under the new rule of Emperor Gia Long to offer him a way out from the influence of the Thai court. As will be the case with a fairly large amount of Cambodian royal politics, the king has three brothers, but they're not exactly aligned with him in his interest in pursuing relations more with the Vietnamese than with the Thai. In fact, when a conflict breaks out between Siamese and Vietnamese armies within Cambodian territory, the three brothers will actually flee to Bangkok, and King Chan will be left to fully embrace this new Vietnamese side of the situation. What may have been a fairly typical example of the grass seems greener on the other side, soon enough, King Chan is performing fairly patronizing rituals twice a month, where he and his entourage, being forced to wear Vietnamese bureaucratic costumes, had to go visit a Vietnamese temple within his palace and bow down to a stone tablet that bore the Vietnamese emperor's name. This scenario would continue basically for about 15 years, and Chan would be stuck with his decision to side with Vietnam. This is the time when the Vietnamese emperor began digging the Van Tay Canal and using, as well as perhaps abusing, Cambodian labor in order to construct it. We've already mentioned the story about the master's tea. And perhaps one of the results of this seeming mistreatment of Cambodians by the Vietnamese, there's actually a general rebellion against Vietnamese rule. And here is David Chandler's take on it. Quote, "It's unclear how large the rebellion was or how much of a threat it posed in military and territorial terms. We know little about its goals beyond the assassination of Vietnamese. Vietnamese records understandably play down its importance, while the locally oriented sources probably exaggerate its extent, momentum, and success. All the sources agree, however, that it was directed against the Vietnamese rather than against King Chan and his officials, and that monks, former monks, and local officials were active within its ranks." End quote. The next significant milestone in this period of Cambodia being under Vietnamese influence was in the 1830s, when the Siamese, under Rama III, would look to invade southern Vietnam. And there are a couple of important things that happened because of this. This was Rama III up against Emperor Minh Mang, who was the son of Gia Long. And Rama was looking to humiliate the new Vietnamese ruler for his attempts to undermine Thai influence in Laos. He may have also had ambitions about getting a better footing south of China for trade along the sea. The second part of Rama's plan relied on the couple of Cambodian brothers of King Chan, Im and Duong, and there was rumors that maybe one of these could be set up as the new king of Cambodia, and maybe there was enough support from local Khmer to do so. Rama would be able to sweep through Cambodia, topple the Vietnamese, set up his own court with either Im or Duong on the throne, and therefore would have a king loyal to Siam once again. This would lead to more favorable conditions to attack southern Vietnam and gain that bit of territory. And the reason this seemed like an opportune time to do this rather extravagant plan was that the area around Saigon in southern Vietnam was currently in a state of revolt against Emperor Minh Mang. And this was in large part due to his posthumous humiliation of a high-ranking official that was more friendly than he was to both Europeans and Catholics. Minh Mang was staunchly anti-Western in his policies, as well as outwardly hostile toward Christians and missionaries. We'll return to this in a moment, but the revolt in southern Vietnam led Rama III to think that this was the time, in his own words, to restore the kingdom of Cambodia and punish the insolence of Vietnam. So how did this all work out? Well, Initially, the campaign was a success. The Vietnamese fled Cambodia, and they took King Chan with them. The Thai forces occupied Phnom Penh, but their attacks on Saigon were less successful, and they were eventually pushed back. On a similar note, their attempts to put either Im or Duong in power in Cambodia also failed, as the two brothers of King Chan failed to attract enough support. Eventually, the whole thing just couldn't be maintained, and the Thai armies either disintegrate or retreat back to the northwest of Cambodia, to the provinces of Battambang and Siem Reap. Im and Duong are also brought back there and given a modicum of administrative control, mostly to give them some stature with the local Khmer and to start building support for perhaps another eventual time that they could take back control of Cambodia. As this Siamese wave that crashed up against southern Vietnam eventually completely retreated back to the northwest of Cambodia, King Chan was put back into power in Phnom Penh by the Vietnamese, but this time it was going to be different. Cambodia was now basically a protectorate of Vietnam and was going to be more or less administered by Vietnamese. The Siamese attack on his country led Emperor Minh Mang to think that the buffer that Cambodia was supposed to be providing against Siamese power to not be really effective. To shore up this buffer, what he did was appoint a general named Trong Minh Giang to head up a kind of civilizing mission, which was going to be primarily aimed at shoring up Vietnamese security by heightening the number of Vietnamese soldiers in Cambodia, and that would hopefully stop any further incursions that could be made by Siam. Trong Minh Giang was basically going to be the emperor's man in Cambodia and make everything happen the way it was supposed to happen. Like when an area manager comes to your office and says, no, we're doing it this way now. Here is what David Chandler writes about this mission for General Jiang. Quote, he needed King Chan and his officials to provide the Vietnamese with labor, rice, and soldiers. Chan seems to have needed the Vietnamese less for what they could provide materially, but probably for what they could provide in protection from assassination or revolt. Like later outsiders operating in Cambodia, Jiang probably expected too much from the king and his officials, and before 1834 was over, he reported pessimistically to the Vietnamese capital that we have tried to punish and reward the Cambodian officials according to their merits and demerits. We have asked the king to help us, but he has hesitated to do so. After studying the situation, we have described that Cambodian officials only know how to bribe and be bribed. Officers are sold, nobody carries out orders, everyone works for their own account. When we tried to recruit soldiers, the king was perfectly willing, but the officials concealed great numbers of people. When we wanted to compile a list of meritorious officials, well, they were perfectly willing to be on the list, but the king was not willing to let them be on the list because he was jealous. For the last 4 months, nothing has been accomplished. End quote. As Chandler kind of alludes to there, some of the experiences that General Jiang is having there will be fairly reminiscent of some of the complaints that the US military will make during the Cambodian Civil War in the 1970s. But what we gather from how he is reporting this back to the emperor in Vietnam is a sense that maybe the Khmer aren't really going to be up to the task of what is essentially just being a defensive buffer between Vietnam and Siam. And less than half a year after General Jiang would send that back to Wei, well, the Cambodian king will die. This leads to another headache for the Vietnamese, because King Chan didn't have any sons and his eldest daughter was suspected of being pro-Siamese. So the decision was made to put Chan's second daughter, Princess Mei, on the throne. And this change of leadership corresponded with a very large increase in what could be seen as the Vietnamization of Cambodia. This was all aimed at resisting the Thai, but now there was also an attempt at arming and mobilizing the Khmer to do this, as well as colonizing the region with more Vietnamese and implementing cultural reforms that were supposed to civilize the Khmer and produce a greater amount of control of the population for Emperor Minh Mang. What the emperor would also do in colonizing Cambodia with Vietnamese was use criminals from within Vietnam to transfer into Cambodia. Now, he justified this on the grounds that, and I'm quoting him here, military convicts and ordinary prisoners, if kept in jail, would prove useless. Therefore, it would be better for them to be sent to Cambodia and live among the people there who could benefit from their teaching. Now, what he's kind of saying there is that a Vietnamese criminal, if sent to Cambodia, would probably make a more productive member of society than your average innocent Khmer would. Just to reinforce some of the apparent attitudes that the Vietnamese emperor had about Cambodians, here's another address to his general there, where he says, "All of the shortcomings you're experiencing there stem from the laziness of Cambodians. My instructions to you are, teach them to use oxen, teach them to grow more rice, teach them to raise mulberry trees, pigs and ducks. They should be taught to speak Vietnamese, as well as our style of dress and table manners. If there is any outdated or barbarous custom that can be simplified or repressed, do so." End quote. So what the emperor is saying there is basically, oh, okay, so I get that you're having problems, but basically to fix that, we're just going to have to change just about everything about the Cambodians in order for this to get going. It's another example of that cultural schism between the two peoples. And I'm not pointing it out to try and make the Vietnamese look bad here. This general attitude is par for the course in these eras. But what I am trying to do is just reinforce some of the animosity that is growing between the two peoples that will end up in massacres in the 20th century. The more context we have for that, and the more understanding we have of this dynamic, the better. And to provide some balance to that point, there are many sources that show, to borrow David Chandler's phrase, Min Maung's ideological framework to include a lot of interest in Cambodia. He was trying to be fair, and I guess in his own mind, trying to help. He was trying to make the people there better, more civilized in his mind. For example, in 1838, the Vietnamese emperor bemoans the intransigence, saying things like, "We brought you security. It cost us millions, by the way. We stationed troops to keep the peace. We brought you out of the mud and into a warm feather bed. Anyone who can think should be thankful to our court. Why are there people who are hating us and believing the rebels?" End quote. And the rebellion he is talking about there is actually another general Khmer uprising against the Vietnamese on a much larger scale than the one in the late 1820s. This one, supported by Siam, came after further attempts to assimilate and administer Cambodia. This even led to the Vietnamese removing Princess Mai from power, and the situation only became worse by the 1840s. Princess Mai and her sisters were taken to Vietnam, and their disappearance, along with some other more complex economic, religious, and social factors, may have been the cause for this widespread revolt against the Vietnamese. This ongoing period of revolt really signaled the widespread failure of Vietnam to complete their civilizing mission, or to have really solidified their administrative structures within the country. And it's hard to say how Minh Mang would have handled this revolt as it went on, as he will die at the end of 1841. The years leading up into this revolt, as well as the revolt itself, were naturally a fairly bad time to be living in Cambodia, as this kind of general revolt takes a large toll on rural lifestyles that are particularly centered on subsistence farming. The fact that the elders in Pol Pot's village referred to this period as the years of calamity goes a long way in showing you just how much of an impact this general revolt in this period of instability had on the psyche of your average Cambodian. This period of general revolt and conflict between Siam and Vietnam in Cambodia would actually last for 7 more years after the death of Emperor Minh Mang, and would only end when a compromising peace was found where the Vietnamese would give back Cambodia to Siam. And before we really tackle this resolution and what that means for Cambodia, what I want to do is take a quick look back at Minh Mang's rule within Vietnam during his time as emperor, as it's not only his policies for Cambodia that will have an impact on this story, but also his internal policies, as these will eventually manifest in one of the more apparent reasons that the French will come and punish, as well as eventually conquer, Vietnam. So if we return briefly to that general revolt in southern Vietnam, the one against Minh Mang in the 1830s that Rama III had looked to take advantage of. You might recall from the last episode, in our discussion of Gia Long's unification of Vietnam, remember that his eldest son had been the subject of Pierre de Barhain's attempt to, well, essentially convert him to Catholicism in a way that would set up the new dynastic rulers of Vietnam to be Christian. This would have naturally had quite a large impact on the way the country was run, not only just for, you know, the Christian missionaries already living there, but also for the possibility of further entanglement with European powers, as religion was often used as a kind of soft power to gain more influence. Gia Long, a committed Orthodox Confucian, was not too keen on his son attempting to become a Christian. But despite this, and probably because he owed the priest quite a bit in his journey to becoming emperor, Gia Long afforded the missionaries within Vietnam during his rule quite a bit of leniency, and maintained some posts for Frenchmen within his new kingdom. When Gia Long would eventually die, there was a problem in choosing his successor. Minh Mang, despite not being the next in line, attained the throne to a large extent because of the Confucian orthodoxy that he shared with his father, as well as his staunch isolationist and anti-Western views. The decision to give him the throne, however, was not completely unanimous. There were some political camps that were more inclined to give the throne to one of the sons of Prince Khan, the eldest of Gia Long's sons, who had accompanied Pierre de Barhain to Versailles, but had died before his father. The reasons for some camps thinking that this was a better route to take varied between a religious inclination toward Catholicism as a belief system, or perhaps they thought that being more open and friendly with powers in Europe would mean that they could utilize more technology and advanced European weaponry. This led to a dynamic where, not completely sure of his own position in power, the Emperor Minh Mang would distrust those that were close to either European interests or Catholic ones. This would eventually turn into a persecution of those perceived to be aligned with either of these interests. Repression of Catholics, or simply those that were friendly to them, was in large part a cause for that rebellion in southern Vietnam against his rule, and it was able to find support from Catholic missionaries. This gave the emperor proof that Catholicism and the missionaries that were spreading this faith were indeed a foreign implant that was seeking to undermine and even challenge his rule. The repression that followed resulted in tens of thousands of Christians being killed during the rebellion and in the years following, including many French missionaries. Some, like Jean-Charles Cornet, were tortured, dismembered, and their heads placed publicly on display. Naturally, if you're a missionary in Vietnam, you might be looking to return to Europe out of fear, or at least contact those back home to inform them of the situation as well as the persecution that you are facing. Eventually, this will be used, more or less as an excuse, for France to invade and to protect its citizens. It could be framed as a just war by them, you know, punishing some far-off, heathenous country who were offending the word of God by butchering its preachers. This repression of Catholics would go on for years and not be acted upon by the French until the early 1860s. But I just wanted to wrap up a couple of these details, as it is directly linked to the activities of Pierre de Barhain before the French Revolution and provides the context for French involvement in the region. What's interesting to ponder here as well is, what if Pierre de Barhain had never been sent to southern Vietnam as a missionary, what if he had never met the young Prince Nguyen, hiding him from the Tay Son Rebellion and eventually joining him in a quest to take back Vietnam for the Nguyen dynasty? What if he hadn't gone back to Versailles and talked to Louis XVI and signed that treaty? A treaty which, by the way, would be brought up by the French, who would say, hey, you know how you got to power? Weren't we supposed to get a port or something out of that? To which the Vietnamese would say, no, where were our ships? You didn't give us any guns. You didn't get any ports. There was this entanglement between Vietnam and France. But it's also interesting to wonder about the effect it may have had on Cambodia. Like, what if Pierre de Bahien hadn't helped the eventual Gia Long unify Vietnam? Would a different leader have initiated the same policies of assimilation and general repression that Minh Mang had? Or by the same token, would there have been many French missionaries within Vietnam to warrant the French noticing their persecution, thus removing any apparent reasons for them to invade and eventually colonize the entirety of Indochina? These kinds of counterfactuals are interesting to think about. I mean, naturally they don't have much bearing on the actual history, but it's just part of what I'm trying to do here in explaining this story going quite far back, because you can see how these little things that might not seem like such a big deal end up culminating in these large events or forces that will have huge ramifications, particularly as we reach the 20th century. But for now, in our story about Cambodia, we can return there and see how the kingdom transitions once again, following this general rebellion against the Vietnamese in the late 1840s. Once Minh Mang had died in 1841, his son and successor, Thieu Tri, continued the policies that saw Christians persecuted and foreign influence kept out of Vietnam. But in Cambodia, the new Vietnamese emperor was far less concerned with quashing this general rebellion and more interested in ending this war with Siam than his father had been. During this period, the Siamese had begun consolidating their control over northwest Cambodia, and the provinces of Battambang and Siem Reap had become a base for their operations. There, they had set up the Khmer leader that they were hoping to put on the throne once Vietnam's grip on Cambodia had eventually loosened. The future king would end up being Duong, the last remaining brother of King Chan. After years of fighting between the Thai and the Vietnamese, eventually a stalemate would ensue. And as the Vietnamese emperor was less interested in controlling Cambodia, as well as colonizing and civilizing it, a face-saving scenario for both parties was found. The Vietnamese agreed to let Duong become king of Cambodia, which would tacitly allow the Siamese to have influence over the country once again. But Duong had to come to the Vietnamese capital and pledge an official subservience to Vietnam. After he did this, the Vietnamese returned the royal regalia to the Cambodian delegation and allowed them to return. This was the end of the Vietnamese administration of Cambodia, a scenario that had seen many Cambodian customs subjected to a targeted policy of what we could term as assimilation. Most importantly, Theravada Buddhism, something that the Vietnamese had relegated from the status of state religion, would be brought back with the new king, and the Cambodian people were ecstatic to have what looked like a genuine ruler once again. This restoration of the king, as well as their religion, was a sign to them that he was legitimate and could embody some of the spiritual power that a Cambodian king is supposed to maintain. He was anointed by Thai and Cambodian religious officials in April 1848, at the age of 52, and after spending almost 25 years in exile. His reign would usher in a brief period of peace and prosperity that hadn't been seen in the kingdom for decades. The Siamese, although they did leave some troops scattered around and were certainly in power, they were much less concerned with administering the Cambodians to the same extent that the Vietnamese had recently been, and Cambodian officials, as well as King Duong, were able to make political decisions that were thought to be restorative in nature. So the new king had Cambodia back once again. Not completely independent, but as we said, he certainly had a greater deal of autonomy than what the previous Vietnamese-dominated rulers of the kingdom had been dealing with. However, looking back at the regional power dynamic at this time between the three kingdoms, little had changed. Cambodia was still dependent on one or the other of its neighbours to ensure it wasn't completely taken over by the other one. Duong may have looked to alter this arrangement in a fairly big way by asking, well, what if there was a third party that Cambodia could appeal to for protection? Someone who could break up this tug of war that his kingdom seemed to be stuck with. Some historians claim that it may have been due to the influence of certain Catholic missionaries in and around his court, but basically, Duong will get the idea that France could be brought into this equation. Naturally, he's still under the control of Siam, and the Vietnamese still have an eye on the whole situation, so it's not like Duong can make any particularly large show of trying to get this outside party to help him out. But in 1853, he'll send a variety of gifts to the new Emperor of France, Napoleon III. You know, part of that tributary system we were talking about before. And he will offer his humble homage. Nothing official, but he just lets the French know that maybe he's open to something here. Well, 3 years after that, a French diplomatic mission was sent to the royal palace in Udon. They had a treaty of cooperation, something that would outline what this relationship between France and Cambodia might look like. Usually these documents stipulate the what do I get in return parts of the deal, like we saw in the last episode, where you might sign away certain rights to the bigger, more powerful country, usually meaning they get access to some of your resources, maybe a port, as well as a say in local politics, and probably some religious freedoms for Catholics. This French diplomatic mission, and their draft treaty, is barred from seeing King Duong by Thai officials, and they're sent away. Now this makes sense. It's like someone else coming to your front door and asking if they can come in and see if your wife or husband would like to come out on a date. In that scenario, you're unlikely to welcome them in and hear what they have to say. So I guess you could call these initial overtures between Duong and the French to be rebuffed. Not because France isn't interested in the region, but because Siam's still standing in the doorway and saying, oh, no, I'm in control of this situation. King Duong had an openness to foreigners in his court, in part because of a friendship with a French missionary, Monsieur Jean-Claude Miche, who may have been the one facilitating these ideas for the new Khmer king. This is a scenario we've seen a few times in the show so far, and Duong's Catholic friend was a big supporter of that failed French diplomatic mission in 1856. He will also be instrumental in getting Duong to welcome the French naturalist Henri Mouhot for a visit in 1860. Now, a naturalist is a kind of old-school word for a person who's a general expert in natural history. Charles Darwin could be considered a naturalist, but so could modern examples like David Attenborough or maybe Steve Irwin. It's a fairly wide descriptor. I do want to linger on Mouhot for a while, not because of the erroneous claim that he somehow discovered Angkor, but because of the diary of his travels, which was posthumously published. It provides us with a really great primary source that we can use to have a look at Cambodia during this time period. The diary itself doesn't have the most imaginative title, it's just called Travels in the Central Parts of Siam, Cambodia and Laos during their years 1858 to 61. And while the title lacks a bit of zazz, the content itself is quite remarkable. However, on this note, I should ask forgiveness once again and using another foreigner's travel memoir of Cambodia to use as our primary source here, just like we did with Chow Tukon back in our discussions of Angkor. This does just speak to that general lack of sources that we have coming directly out of Cambodia before the modern era, however, so forgive me. So Mouhot's travels in Indochina, that you know, form the basis of the diary begin in 1858 when he arrives in the Thai capital, and he uses that as a kind of base for his excursions into the rest of Indochina, arriving in Cambodia right at the end of 1859. Quite early in his account of his travels in Cambodia, Muhon will actually encounter King Duang somewhere near Kampot, and I'm just going to read you his account of that encounter. I should also say that I will refrain from using a terrible French accent here, so just excuse that, but here we go. Quote, "The king was seated on an old European chair, with two officers on each side of him, who from time to time would offer the king, while kneeling, a lit cigarette or some betel, which they always kept at the ready. At a little distance stood his guards, some holding pikes that were ornamented at the top with white tufts. Others had sheathed sabres in their hands. The ministers and officials knelt a few steps below His Majesty, and on our entrance, chairs that were similar to the king's were placed for us close to him. Like his subjects, he generally wears nothing but a kind of silken robe. His was composed of a fine yellow silk, confined at the waist by a magnificent belt of gold, studded with precious stones. In Cambodia, as in Siam, it's necessary to offer presents if one desires to gain the royal favour. I had accordingly brought with me an English walking stick gun as a gift for the king. It at once attracted his notice. 'Pray, show me that cane,' he said in Cambodian. I gave it to him. 'Is it loaded?' asked he, seeing that it was a firearm. 'No, sire.' He then begged for a cap, snapped it, unscrewed the barrel, and examined it with great attention. 'If it would be agreeable to His Majesty,' I said, 'I shall be happy to offer it to the king.' 'What did it cost?' asked the king to his official. 'Oh, sire, I dare not ask, Mr. Muhot. In Europe, no one tells the price of what he gives.'" End quote. Isn't that all fantastic? I don't know. I just love this stuff where you've got these scenes that are like straight out of a movie for me, where you've got these cultures just meeting in these brilliant ways. Anyway, Muhot will end up gaining permission from the king to travel around, and he will soon leave Kampot to head to the royal capital at Udong. Before we get there, though, it's worth just picking up on a couple of the notes he does make about Kampot, like how the marketplace of the small city, and it does seem small, he says that it's only consisting of around 300 houses, and he calls it rather poor compared to what he's seen in Siam, reflecting the general disparity in wealth between the two countries. He also says that the general trade going on there is done by non-Khmer members of the community. He says the town itself is chiefly occupied by Chinese and made up of a number of thatched huts where a hustle and bustle of trade is done on mats which are laying on the ground, and where Khmer women are the predominant natives who are present in this scenario. These passages struck me as fairly reminiscent of some of the descriptions that Chao Te Kwan was making 500 years beforehand in Angkor, and fits generally with notions that some aspects of life in Cambodia have an extremely long history. Anyway, Muhot will eventually arrive in the capital, and is once again received by the king, and they have another interesting conversation in the palace, which I'll give you a snippet of. It begins with the king asking, "How do you like my city?" To which Muhot replies that it is splendid. The king says that all the palaces and pagodas which you see from here have been built in 1 year since my return from Siam. In another year, they will all be finished. Formerly, Cambodia was very extensive, but the Annamites, which is the Vietnamese, have deprived us of many provinces. To which Muhot replies, "Sire, perhaps the time has arrived for you to retake them. The French are assailing them on one side. Why don't you attack them from the other?" The Majesty did not reply, but offered me a cigar and inquired my age. Now, from that little exchange there, we actually get a fair bit of context for the time that Cambodia is currently in. Remember, Duang had essentially been in exile before being able to return to Cambodia and claim the throne. This is that restorative era we spoke about earlier, and it's reflected in his need to rebuild the royal city. Duang also reinforces some of the ideas that we've been associating with this period. The resentment of the Vietnamese is explicit, as well as a sense of loss about Cambodian territory. Now, the one aspect that is mentioned here that we've not really spoken about yet, and that's what Muhat tells the king about France and what his country is doing conquering the Vietnamese. We will explore that in a little bit more detail in a moment, but I just want us to keep the story in Cambodia for now and skip ahead a little in Muhat's diaries, because he won't stay in Udong too long before having an extended stay in a remote village, as well as eventually heading to Angkor. But before we get to his quite famous descriptions of that old Khmer city, I just want to run through a few highlights of the diary in the year leading up to that trip. One of these includes another interesting description of an after-dinner conversation that King Duong and Muhat have, in which Duong demonstrates the only English phrase that he knows, which is good brandy, before he then shows off some fine European-made furniture. The king, after he lights a cigar, then produces a wooden music box, which plays La Marseillaise, which quite moves the patriotic Muhat. Another little fun scene, but it also conveys to the reader how the Cambodian king is rather cosmopolitan and certainly more open to Europeans than the current Vietnamese ones. Days after this, having secured letters from the king that allowed Muhat to travel around the country without too much fear, he heads from Phnom Penh toward the Tonle Sap and has an extended 3-month stay in a rural village. He describes and draws pictures of traditional Khmer houses, you know, propped up on stilts. And these pictures are reminiscent to anyone who has visited areas of the country outside of the major towns and cities, even today. In one of these villages, he meets a priest, or missionary, that had previously been proselytizing in Vietnam, an activity which saw him beaten and tortured. Again, this brings Muhat to wax lyrical about the mission of his countrymen. And I'll quote you what he says. All honour to thee, noble son of our dear and beautiful country, thou who bravest poverty, privations, fatigue, suffering, and even death, to bring these savages the blessings of religion and civilization. End quote. So at this point, having spent probably about a year in the kingdom, Muhat takes the time to bemoan the state of the country, the condition of the people, talking about this in a way that we can glean quite a lot from when trying to understand what imperialism and colonialism look like in someone's mind. For example, on page 275, we hear him talk about the need for European conquest of this region that he's living in. He speaks about the possibility that France should take this fertile land rather than England, and how with France in Vietnam, it provided this perfect opportunity to secure what could be a valuable cotton-growing region. I'll quote you the sentence here. European conquest, abolition of slavery, wise and protecting laws, as well as the experience, fidelity, and scrupulous rectitude of those who would administer them, would alone effect the regeneration of this state. Under France's sway, it would become a land of plenty. I wish her to possess this land, which would add a magnificent jewel to her crown. He will then go on to list some primary productions of Cambodia, and he really emphasizes cotton, and he says, that important article of commerce thrives here admirably, and as according to report, with civil war in America, it is a question whether we can henceforth calculate on that country for the supply of cotton. If that supply was even to partially fail, what a vast field might be opened up on the banks of the Mekong or the Tonle Sap for European activity, industry, and capital. He goes on to warn that England, with their other possessions in Asia, like India or Australia, could potentially have this whole region, and France would miss out and have to buy from England. In what soon turns into a kind of sales pitch, he sweetens the deal even more, saying that there are precious metals in the mountains here, like gold, and these could all be extracted easily. And what this all kind of highlights is just the general attitudes of your archetypal colonialist in the 19th century. We've got pride in your own country, nationalism, competition with other European powers, gaining territory just so that another country or empire wouldn't get it. The spread of civilization, in his words, spreading the Christian God, not to mention just the simple glory of another jewel in the crown. It's so typical of that old saying, gold, God, and glory. And just when you think it can't get even more cliche, Muhot will go on to hunt a tiger, complain about the heat, and then explore an old jungle-covered temple complex. The man certainly does have a very good handle on language. His descriptions of Angkor are fantastic. He's gifted. And he communicates some of the feelings that I think many of us feel when first stepping into that sacred city. Now, because we've already spent a couple of episodes in and around that area, I won't take too long trying to get you to imagine these places again. But we do need to refer to some of his diary here, as when it is published, it will do a lot of work in popularizing some of the mystique and wonder of Angkor for European audiences. And it's quite easy to see why. Listen to this description of Angkor Wat, for example. One of these temples, a rival to that of Solomon, and erected by some ancient Michelangelo, might take an honorable place beside our most beautiful buildings. It is grander than anything left to us by Greece or Rome, and presents a sad contrast to the state of barbarism in which the nation is now plunged. Here's another one on Angkor Wat. The most beautiful and best preserved of all the remains, and which is also the first which presents itself to the eye of the traveller, making him forget all the fatigue of the journey, filling him with admiration and delight, such as would be experienced on finding a verdant oasis in a sandy desert. End quote. It's pretty good, right? And if you visited the region, you might have had that similar feeling. You know, when you first stand on that bridge, on the moat, and you feel the endorphins flow over you as you marvel at the symmetry and genius that's in front of you. Muhot goes on to provide pages and pages of extremely detailed descriptions and drawings of Angkor Wat before he heads toward Phnom Bekeng. Remember, that's the temple built by Yasovarman that sits on a hill just a couple of kilometers from the complex at Angkor. Now, on top of that temple, as he's looking out across the plains and even upon Angkor Wat sat amongst the jungle in the distance, Muhot writes, "Oh, sad fragility of human things! How many centuries and thousands of generations have passed away, of which history, probably, will never tell us anything? What riches and treasures of art will remain forever buried beneath these ruins? How many distinguished men, artists, sovereigns, and warriors, whose names were worthy of immortality, are now forgotten, laid to rest under the thick dust which covers these tombs." Again, it's pretty powerful stuff. He's got away with words. And unfortunately, about a year after he penned this into his diary, Henry Muhot will die of a malarial fever in the jungles of Laos. And what I've been reading to you will be collected and published soon after his death. He's a fascinating character to me. As we said, he embodies so much of that old school adventurer spirit, problematic as it may be, but you can certainly tell that it's evolved at least from the 1600s and reflects the curious way that Enlightenment values are being infused into this spirit of colonialism and imperialism. We see some strands of the French Revolution in there, as well as his desire to remove aspects of what he would consider ancien regime from Cambodia in order for that country to prosper. To me, he does seem honestly moved and cares about the world that he is exploring. He sees the Khmer as suffering, and within his own cultural context, you can imagine his desire for the civilization of France to reach this kingdom, and for these people to reclaim their former glories as a result. It's certainly patronizing, and it does highlight general racial attitudes from this time period, but I think we can spare him from too much judgment simply because he is a man of his time. On a similar note, the year before Muhot will die, King Duang also will die of illness after having led Cambodia for about 12 years. This is in 1860, and after a short leadership struggle, Duang's eldest son, Norodom, is installed by the Thai on the throne. Norodom had, like his father, also spent most of his life in Bangkok, where he was studying extensively. This served a dual purpose for the Siamese, as they were training the future leader of Cambodia and making sure that he was groomed toward Thai interests. But the other side of it is also just a fairly similar scenario to a hostage situation. Duang was kept from straying away from Siamese control because his own son was held by those that actually kept power. We will sort through the events of this succession in a moment, and return to the actions of Norodom when he will take the throne in the 1860s, as well as how some of Henry Mouhot's desires for France will come to pass in Cambodia. But before we get there, we do need to circle back just once more and touch on the French military campaign that's going on in Vietnam, and turning into one of conquest. In January 1858, instructions that had been originally issued in Paris almost 3 months earlier finally arrived into the hands of Admiral Charles Rigaud de Genouilly. His naval forces had recently been engaged in Chinese waters, in what had been a successful end to the Second Opium War. Now, they were free to be engaged in Indochina, and the instructions that he received led the admiral to spend months preparing 14 vessels and 3,000 men to attack the Vietnamese port city of Turan, or Da Nang. Incidentally, the same place that the first US ground troops would land in just over 100 years' time. Arriving at the coast, a barrage of cannon fire and a quick ground invasion would see the Vietnamese city occupied, thus inaugurating the first phase of the French conquest of Indochina. So how did we get to this point? What led the French to just invade Vietnam? Or as they called it, Annam, or at least that's what they called the middle section of Vietnam. They called all Vietnamese Annamites, but they referred to the northern region around Hanoi as Tonkin, and the southern area around Saigon, that was called Cochin China. So you've got Tonkin, Annam, Cochin China. Well, one of the stated reasons for this invasion was the retribution for the long-standing persecution of Catholics that had been going on in Vietnam. And we've been foreshadowing this since Pierre de Bahain. As I outlined before, this long kind of entanglement, this is more than 70 years earlier that Gia Long and de Bahain had pleaded for French assistance. Well, all of that has eventually reached the point where France has just started blasting this Vietnamese port. However, international relations are rarely as simple as just protecting some people. That noble goal was an influence, especially because of the resurgence that Christianity had found within France following the French Revolution. So that's one cause for Napoleon III's decision to just bombard and begin capturing parts of Vietnam. Another reason, and the more realist assertion, was that Paris saw a possibility to access Chinese trade via the Mekong River. And while they'll soon figure out that there's too many waterfalls in the way for that to be a viable option, it's just apparent that there were economic ambitions that were really at the heart of this endeavour. But the official story was that the alleged mistreatment of these Catholic missionaries was providing the excuse for the French intervention. And the occupation of Da Nang was initially a success, until heat, disease, and a lack of supplies, not to mention a much more resistant Vietnamese than what was expected, which is a theme that we'll see again and again, forced the French to abandon the campaign in Annam and look toward the south, towards Saigon, as the new potential base for the conquest of the region. Saigon would fall quite quickly to the French, without very much resistance, in February 1859, which is the period that Henry Mouhot was discussing with King Duang a year after. Eventually, the Emperor of Vietnam, Thu Duc, had to sign a treaty that would provide the French with ports in Annam as well as many provinces in and around Saigon, essentially handing over all of Cochin China, the region that had originally been Cambodian territory, to the French. This is a moment in the podcast where I'm actually pretty happy that the focus is more on Cambodia, because the entire campaign for France and the conquest of the rest of Vietnam is quite a stop-start, staggered process, and it's a little bit too complex, as well as the fact that it'll basically just lead us into too much territory that will need further explanation. I don't really want to touch the Franco-Prussian Wars back in Europe, or the eventual conflict with pirates and the Chinese on the border between Tonkin and China. The conflict between the French and the Vietnamese is brutal, and it'll cover almost two decades. It's also going to provide a fairly stock-standard example of colonial conquests in this period, where the more advanced European military will simply prove too much for a native resistance. By 1887, all three states of Vietnam, from a French perspective, will be incorporated into French Indochina, with Laos following in 1893. But, as the purpose of this series is focused on Cambodia, what we really need to know here is just that France, by the end of the 19th century, has taken Vietnam by force. Meanwhile, in Cambodia, a similar outcome will occur, but with not one shot being fired. Alright, back in Cambodia. The last thing we said that was Duang had died and his son Norodom was now being put on the throne by the Siamese. What I left out of that situation, though, was that Siam had said, "Okay, Norodom, it's your turn to be in charge of Cambodia now. You can be the ruler." And they made him king, kind of. They gave it to him on a kind of provisional basis. They officially only made him just their viceroy of Cambodia. Now, how do you make someone king on a provisional basis? Well, in this case, it was done by withholding something very important to the royalty in Cambodia. Their regalia. Something that I've remained a little bit vague about in the series so far, so we're just going to explain that now. One of the most important pieces of these emblems of royalty for Cambodia is Priya Maha Mokot Riak, the Great Crown of Victory, a multi-tiered, cone-shaped cap made of solid gold and precious gems, and like a lot of old Khmer architecture, supposed to symbolize the sacred mountain of Mount Meru. This crown, along with some other precious items like a sword, were bestowed upon the leader of the country as an official and spiritual way of defining that person as someone in line with the great universal monarchs of the old Khmer Empire. In the period leading up to his coronation, these items had sometimes been kept by either Siam or Vietnam as a conspicuous show of power to the subordinate Khmer. Naturally, the hierarchy of a power situation can fairly easily be seen if one country is literally holding the items that you need to call yourself king. Anyway, a rather official way of Vietnam and Thailand showing each other who was in control of Cambodia, remember that old tributary system, was also shown with who was holding the regalia. Like when Vietnam grew weary of the wars that we were discussing in and around the late 1840s, Tu Duc found an official way of giving control back to the Siamese by returning the royal regalia to the Siamese so they could give it to Duang and they would make him king. Now when he died, Norodom was called up from Bangkok and the Thai made him king, but they kept the regalia and the official ceremony where these things were bestowed upon the leader did not take place. So therefore, he wasn't officially king. Naturally, this situation wasn't the best for Norodom, and he felt that the Siamese were overstepping the boundary from patronizing to completely demeaning him and his rule in Cambodia. Which is why Norodom decided to pick up from where his father left off and look toward an outside power to free him from Thai influence. Norodom opened up negotiations with the French in 1863, but this time, instead of the negotiations having to occur via the embassy in Bangkok, the French are literally next door. They've conquered Cochin China the year before this. As David Chandler puts it in A History of Cambodia, the French admiral in charge of southern Vietnam, having no immediate war to fight, looked for a peaceful conquest and began dreaming about Cambodia. So we've got a king in Cambodia who's looking for an out, and we've got an admiral in charge of southern Vietnam who's looking for another jewel for the crown. And when I use that phrase, I'm not saying that the writings of Henry Mouhot directly influenced that French admiral's decision, but it's easy to see how ideas like his were being floated around about a country that is full of resources and potential, but is being poorly administered, and that these ideas might lead someone who is basically in a stalemate with a hostile enemy to just decide to pop next door and get a deal signed that's going to include all of this new territory into your new burgeoning empire. From the Khmer perspective, we're also reminded of the actions of someone like King Angchan I in the 1500s, in his attempt to protect the old capital of Long Vek from an incoming attack from the Siamese. The most attractive option for him was to ask a stronger European kingdom for protection and sign a treaty with them. And while it didn't exactly work out with him and the Spanish, he didn't have many other options. In times of need or uncertainty, the temptation for Cambodian leaders to throw aspects of independence away and allow a foreign power to prop them up is hard to ignore, and it's also easy to understand. It's something we'll see recurring fairly often in the post-Angkor era, and it will be a theme that we see vividly when discussing the lead-up to the Cambodian Civil War in the 1970s, and arguably in present-day Cambodian politics. For Norodom, the French will actually begin negotiating from a position of pressure. Diplomats and officials convinced him, as they now had control of Cochin China, well, the French actually had a right to exercise suzerainty over Cambodia, as they'd inherited this right from the Vietnamese when they conquered them. They told him that if he signed a treaty with them, he would be free from Thai influence and have independence. A promising prospect for the king. We talked about the mercantile eyes that France had been viewing Cambodia through at this point in time, but they also assumed that Britain had similar attentions for Siam, and that perhaps it would make sense to set up Cambodia as a kind of barrier between the two colonial rivals. This is classic balance of power thinking. Eventually, they will force Norodom to sign a treaty, and as far as they're concerned, Cambodia is now under their control. Naturally, this news isn't very well received by the Siamese, who've just lost their entire vassal state. And for them, they've got a pretty solid argument here, because Norodom was their guy. He wasn't even king of Cambodia. We made him the viceroy there, but he wasn't in the position to sign anything away. He wasn't even really in charge. To follow that analogy from before, this is like the tough person coming in off the street, asking your partner out on a date, and then while they're out dating, they also decide to just give this person the keys to the car and the house, and then I come home to find out that it's not mine anymore. By this point in the negotiations, Norodom is actually starting to get kind of cold feet. The French officials are setting up around the palace, and he hears word from Bangkok that King Mongkut wants him to come to Siam so that they can crown him and naturally take control back from the French. Norodom decides to accept the invitation, but he plays this off to the French officials in the palace like, oh no, I'm not doing anything, I'm just going to Thailand real quick, don't worry about it. Naturally, they see through this, and they do warn him that there would be consequences if he left, which he did anyway. A royal procession leaves Udong on the 3rd of March. Now, the French officials send word by horseback that if he doesn't return, he won't be allowed back. The navy will head to Kampot and prevent him from coming back to the palace, and they will take control of Cambodia without him. Eventually, Norodom would be convinced by this, and knows that angering France here wouldn't serve his interests. The royal procession is turned around, and he heads back to Udong. The French have their man back, and a position of strength to negotiate their terms with Siam. Norodom would be crowned in a ceremony by both Siam and France, and for the first time, a Cambodian king would accept the royal crown of victory from a European. France was able to negotiate a deal with Bangkok that allowed them to keep some of the northwestern provinces of Cambodia in exchange for Siamese support of the new French protectorate over the rest of the country. And that's how Cambodia became part of the new colony of France. A colony that would eventually include all of Vietnam and Laos by the dawn of the 20th century. But for Cambodia, This new status was not found through some kind of war or conflict, like in Vietnam. It was found from a position of weakness. Okay, well, that was a long one. Thank you for getting this far. I really hope you're enjoying the series, and it's one that's become much bigger than I originally intended. I'd actually envisioned, almost 2 years ago now, that the series would have started roughly from this point that we just ended on. But I realized that the whole story needs to be told, and history is just one of those subjects where you keep asking why, and that inevitably means you have to go back a little further and a little further. And, well, here's the result. If you did start listening to this series with an interest that's focused more on the events of the 20th century than anything else, then I hope that you're happy that we're finally getting there. We've made it to the modern era. And from here, we will be focused on the themes of that century and the lives of those who will bring about and live through the Cambodian nightmare. I'll see you next time. My name is Lachlan Peters, and thank you very much for listening.